Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and happy Tuesday. Today is June 27th. I can't believe we're just almost at the end of June, and we got the 4th of July coming up, and I hope you got some fun plans already in place, and if not, I hope you get some, because it is a great holiday. It's just a time where you can just celebrate and have picnics and get together with family and start family arguments, and that's just a lot of fun. I always look forward to that. So speaking of arguments, I was reading an article this morning briefly that was talking about that couples that argue together are actually happier. And I thought, here are some points. This woman, Zoe Marshall, I don't know who she is, but she said, don't run from disagreement, she said. That only makes things worse. Try to stay with it and work it out calmly. She said, avoid going around in circles. Be fair. Don't say things you'll regret later because you were mad. That's no fun. Resolve every fight before you go to sleep or leave each other for the day. That makes sense. That's right out of the Bible. It said, don't let the sun set on your anger. Yeah, I was awake for 3 months 1 year. Own your own mistakes and apologize. There you go. Forgive and don't rub in their wrongdoing once you have forgiven. That makes sense too, doesn't it? And let's see, when calm, go over the issue again in a loving way. Discuss what you can both do to feel better. Negotiate until both your needs are met. That sounds reasonable too. And learn from your mistakes. Don't lash out in frustration to hurt someone. It's just more mess you have to apologize for later. Plus, it's mean. So anyway, those are some good tidbits I thought I would just bring up. All right, we've got on the studio line coming up, Dr. Don Thompson, and he's a first-time guest on the show, so we're looking forward to getting to know him a little bit, and he's going to give us his perspective on the new healthcare bill. Will it fix Obamacare's problems? That's going to be very interesting. It's 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a very short break and bring on Dr. T. Well, I want to sing right now, but no one would want to hear me sing. That's the amazing part. They'd want to hear you sing, though, Rebecca. You've got a great voice. I have on the studio line Dr. Don Thompson. He's from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. He serves as the Director of Global Health Outreach in the Clinical Short-Term Medical Missions Division of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Good morning, Dr. Thompson.
Good morning, Bill. This is Bill, right?
Yeah, this is Bill. Correct.
Hey, Bill, how are you this morning?
I'm really good, and I so appreciate you coming on the show. We love all of our doctors from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. So thank you for coming on, and tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I, as you mentioned, I am the Director of Global Health Outreach, which is our short-term international medical missions arm, where we send about 48 to 50 teams a year to about 24, 25 countries around the world to deliver primary medical and dental care to people who are pretty much at the end of the road and the end of the trail. They're truly the last and the lost and the least, and have little to no access to health care. We build great commission disciple makers on our teams and then within the populations that we serve. I myself, I've got 27 years in the Air Force. I retired about 8 years ago as a colonel and have had a great time in the Air Force and a great time since the Air Force, and I am well caffeinated, which I hear is important to you.
On this show, it's very, very important. So do you come from a family of medicine? Was your dad a doctor or your grandpa or somebody?
No, I'm the first.
Wow.
I'm the first.
Wow. Well, I love your heart for missions, and I have a friend who's a medical missionary, and when I hear stories, I'm absolutely amazed at how they serve. And you talk about the least, and what was the least in the...
least and the lost and the last.
Yeah, there you go.
I believe Christ referred to people that way, to the lost that way.
Yeah. Well, let's focus our attention about the new healthcare bill, and what are you thinking about this? And is it going to fix the Obamacare problems?
It's going to certainly take things in the right direction.
Good.
The challenges with Obamacare were our healthcare delivery system was hurting at the time. It's been hurting for several decades. Because, of course, healthcare, you have these three opposing points of a triangle. You want high-quality healthcare, you want access to that healthcare, and then you want it at a reasonable cost. And whenever you improve one, like you lower the cost, then you almost always decrease the quality and decrease the access. Obamacare did not do much to improve that. As a matter of fact, many would say it made those worse. It's raised the costs. It's reduced the access, and it's reduced the quality because it has used as its main focus putting more and more people in a failing healthcare delivery system that the government runs called Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid has got poor access. It reimburses physicians at a low rate, so more and more physicians are either getting out of medicine or greatly limiting the number of Medicaid patients that they'll take, and then the quality is suffering. So both the House bill and the Senate bill that seems to move things even a little bit more in the right direction are taking steps. I have to emphasize taking steps. Believe me, it's not the panacea in fixing everything, but it looks like it's going to gradually stop the decay that Obamacare has pushed into the healthcare delivery system, and then over the course of a number of years, we'll start moving things back to a more market-based system where we'll be able to get better access to better care at reasonable cost. And the key there is going to be the healthcare consumer is going to be able to choose more of what they want. And the physician they want, and we're all behind that.
How do we interpret the hysteria when you hear the headlines that if this goes through,
you know,
22... Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you pegged it. It's hysteria. The 22 million people that will lose their health care, I think, is what the Congressional Budget Office came out and said yesterday. It's very interesting. People were forced to buy insurance through the Obamacare market. So you have, I don't know how many millions were forced to get it, and they'll no longer be forced.
Mm-hmm.
And they will choose to make a rational decision that fits their pocketbook and fits their perceived health care needs, and they'll choose not to pay that. And so the CBO is rating that as losing care, which I think is just very misleading. And it is just that. You will have millions of people who choose not to get into a dysfunctional healthcare system that Obamacare was requiring them to do. So you need to have a market-based solution. And the healthcare delivery system, I'm a family practice doc, and my colleagues have been working on a better system since the early 90s, and it's starting to penetrate now. There's something called direct primary care, DPC, where you can find a doc, this is so far primary care docs. It's not specialty care, as far as I know, or hospitals. But you can contract with a doc and pay $75, $100 a month, and they commit to you that they will take care of all your needs, all your primary care needs. So there you go at just $100 a month, you've got access to a high-quality doc. The docs are promised. I mean, when I get marketed about this, I'm told that I'm probably going to work a little bit harder, but there will be much more stability in my practice, and I'm not going to have the massive numbers of people to do all the filings for health insurance. You pay me directly.
Wow.
Therefore, we get around all the administrative middlemen that run the cost up.
That's really interesting, Dr. Thompson. You know, when the CBO comes out with numbers, I used to think that was kind of a important number to get, and then I realized that maybe that doesn't matter either, because I remember when the CBO came out on Obamacare, every Democrat was so giddy about how great the number was, and it was like $980 billion, but it really turns out to be about $2 trillion. So can we trust the CBO numbers?
I think that the Library of Congress keeps CBO reports in their fiction department.
Normally I do the comedy on this show, but I appreciate that.
That's your role. I realize that. No, it doesn't seem to be based on fact. They are pulling out a bunch of stuff, and I believe cherry picking. I believe President Reagan called or someone back in the 80s talked about rosy scenario being the way you looked at things, and I think this is just the opposite of rosy scenario. It's painting things as bleak as possible for what's coming out now in the last few months, and then it painted Obamacare as a rosy scenario, as positive as it could, the scriptures gave us principles on judging whether a prophet was a man of God. If he told the truth, then he was a man of God. If he prophesied something and it did not come true, then certain pretty devastating things should be done there. And I'm not suggesting that happened to the CBO, but I think we need to probably take what they suggest with a ton of salt, not just a grain, but a ton of salt.
Dr. Thompson, you've already given me the phrase of the day, serving the last and the lost and the least. I love it. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I have more questions for you. I want to talk about Planned Parenthood and what they're teaching your child about sex and transgenderism, and also some of these gender-suppressing drugs that the kids are getting as well. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us on the Early Morning Late Show. I'll be right back. Welcome back. It's 18 minutes after the hour. We're having a lively conversation with Dr. Don Thompson from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. And Dr. Thompson, interesting report that the government starts spending less on sex ed. They spend less, and then the pregnancy rates drop. Go figure.
Isn't that interesting? I believe that was a story that came from Great Britain.
It did.
And the National Health System and National Health Service in Britain is the epitome of our poor quality, poor access, and poor cost. But the sex education efforts there were defunded for fiscal reasons, and then all of a sudden things got better, which makes you wonder when the government gets involved, if they make things worse. I don't think we can generalize that across the board. Mm-hmm. But to talk about abstinence education, to really empower young people with decision making, critical thinking skills, can make a difference. So when the effort stops and things get better, then that really means you need to do a reality check on whether you should continue with a program like that.
Mm-hmm. What are kids learning in school today about sex and transgenderism?
It's a whole lot different than when you and I were in junior high and high school. Many adolescents are being validated for all the challenges that they're dealing with, and I've if you look at the different stages of adolescence with what teens go through, they go through, there's physical development, of course, there's intellectual and emotional development, mm-hmm. and you can do that in a closet without being around anyone else, and then there's social development, and that's just absolutely huge. The different stages of adolescence are defined. There are three stages: early, middle, and late. And late adolescence goes from age 18 to 21, which is interesting, because these development stages continue from, they certainly start in about age 11, where early adolescence is, but they go all the way through what we now think of college age. And there's still intellectual development, emotional development, and social development. So people are being taught, kids are being taught things that anticipate them or treat them as if they are adults and able to grasp the long-term effects of things. And yet, one has to question their cognitive development. I saw an article in the most recent World Magazine, article by Jamie Dean, and she quotes an excerpt from a study from the American Academy of Pediatrics, and that the American Academy of Pediatrics is not the more conservative one. They are very much in favor of the transgender agenda, but they published an ex, an excerpt about cognitive development of children, and she quotes that the report argued that children under the age of 14 aren't cognitively capable of crossing a busy street because children lack the perceptual judgment and physical skills needed to consistently get across safely. Those are 14-year-olds.
Wow.
So instead, we're teaching these 14-year-olds things that involve, as some have said, physical mutilation when they're having sex change operations, and then hormonal changes that have subjective judgments only that have never been tested in controlled clinical trials. So it's alarming what's going on in training our adolescents.
That is that's a shocking example about 14-year-olds.
Very much so.
Yeah, not even aware to cross the street by themselves. Okay, now puberty suppression in children that may have gender dysphoria. I always find the onset of puberty kind of curious because I think for girls it's between the ages of about 10 and 12, but for boys it's usually Tuesday at 1:30.
And several years later than 12. I mean, we all know that women are faster than we are in just about everything in life, and we just have to accept that. Girls, it tends to be earlier, and it tends to be related to nutrition. So it's earlier and earlier now as we have better and better nutrition. And in places where I work overseas, it may not begin in girls until age 14 or 15. But it definitely is different from the two sexes.
But if we can't, if we're giving them drugs, that it's going to be suppressing their puberty at such a young age, is that something that the kids fully understand, or is it something that the parents are bringing to the table, or how do you parse that out?
The kids have, I think it's pretty safe to say, based on what I've already said about adolescents, the kids have no understanding of what this is. They're confused. There's no question about them being confused because of the developmental stages that they're going through intellectually and emotionally and socially. So the kids are confused, and they need to be guided in the right direction by those of us who are responsible for them as their parents. And for us to then be hijacking that normal development, instead of helping them get through these times of turmoil and encouraging them to go in the correct way, instead of doing that, we're aborting what the normal things that they're struggling with and validating a turn off of that is not, I'm trying to think of the right term to use, but it's certainly not the right thing for us to be trying to change or stop their adolescence, stop their puberty.
Mm-hmm.
There's no scientific evidence that that's the right thing. There's no scientific evidence that it's safe.
Yeah. Dr. Thompson, we just have less than a minute. I'm curious, do you have a short-term missions trip coming up this summer?
We have many of them. I've got a team in El Salvador right now, and I've got another team in the Dominican Republic right now. And then as soon as those get back, within a few days, I've got a few turning around going to Nicaragua, and another to Dominican Republic, and then one to Africa, to Ghana. So we have plenty of opportunities for people if they're interested in doing these. Most of these in the next few months are full because we're down to the wire.
Sure.
But we would be glad to have people jump on board with us.
I don't use the word hero very often, but I'm using it with you today. I just so admire your life and how you're living it and how you're serving and glorifying God with what you're doing.
Oh, servant is a good enough word. Hero is way over the top, but thanks anyway.
All right. Have a great day, Dr. Thompson, and thanks so much for being on the show.
You too, Bill. I look forward to next time.
Thanks, me too. All right. It's 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be back with lots more. We've got coming up in the next half hour, Kent Dunnington. He's the professor at Biola University. He's written a book called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. This is a fascinating conversation that I'm looking forward to having with him. Be back in a minute. It is half past the hour. After a little news break, we're going to talk to Dr. Kent Dunnington from Biola University on addiction and virtue. That'll be interesting. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the Early Morning Late Show. Bill Arnold here. My next guest is someone that I have admired his work for a couple of years now, and getting him on the show, for me, big thrill. And his name is Kent Dunnington. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Biola University. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Texas A&M and an MTS in theology from Duke University. He's written a book called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. And if you know from my weekend program, my co-host with George Fraser called Real Recovery, this is a subject near and dear to my heart. Kent, good morning.
Good morning.
And now, just so you know, I'm a big, big fan. And so I'm just so thrilled to be able to have you on the show. I'd say let's get to it. Let's open this big bag of snakes, because what I want to do is learn from your perspective this book you've written called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. What is the nature of addiction?
That is a big question, and it's the question that really got me interested in writing this book. There are two predominant models that people use to think about addiction. One is by far the dominant model in contemporary discussions, and it's what in the book I call the disease model. Some people talk about it as the medical model, and the idea there is that addiction is a disease. It's something that happens to us, and therefore it's not something for which people should be blamed. It's something that we should respond to in the same way that we respond to other diseases. So we should feel pity, and we should seek medical assistance for ourselves if we have addictions, or others if they have addictions. So if you put that at one end of the spectrum, addiction is something that happens to us. It's not something that we do. On the extreme other end of the spectrum is what in the book I call the choice model of addiction. Sometimes it's called the moral model of addiction. And the idea there is that addiction is nothing more than a series of bad, immoral choices. And so people are in control of their actions throughout the addictive process, and they just repeatedly choose to do things that they know are harmful to themselves or other people. So on one extreme, our what philosophers call our agency, our ability to control what we do, is completely taken away on the medical model. On the other extreme, we view addicts as people with full agency, and therefore as people that are especially morally corrupt. And to me, both of those models fail. If you know, or if you yourself have been addicted, or if you know people who are addicted, you know that both of those ways of thinking about what's going on in addiction are overly simplified. And so in the book, I try to chart sort of a middle way between those two. And I talk about addiction as a complex habit. And the idea there is that habits actually do, in some sense, remove our agency. When a habit has a profound grip on our lives, we lose a lot of immediate voluntary control over what we do in the domain of that habit. But also that habit is, it's a part of our character. And so a habit is not something that happens to us. In most cases, it's something that we develop. So I try in the book to suggest that if we think about addiction as an incredibly powerful and complex habit, we're in a better position to address it in our lives and in the lives of people that we know and love.
Now, Kent, it seems that we have learned how to medicalize sin, where we're not really thieves anymore, we're kleptomaniacs, and we're not immorally dealing with sexual issues, we're sex addicts. So we're finding language today that's replacing sin. We're getting rid of some of this language and replacing it with terms that are much more sanitized.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's exactly right. One interesting question from the perspective of Christian thought is, why is that? You know, what's going on? Part of what I try to do in the book is there's a certain approach to the addiction and recovery field that is highly critical and highly suspect, and even sometimes things in terms of a conspiracy, you know, sort of secular conspiracy against Christianity or a medical conspiracy. My book is not, it does not take that perspective. However, I do think that there has been a loss of the resources that Christianity brings to bear on thinking about this aspect of our lives. Now, why is that? Part of what I suggest in the book is that in many respects, it's the fault of the church and of Christianity. I think that there is a strong reaction, for instance, in AA against the language of sin. But if you go back and look at why AA is so resistant to the language of sin, it's because so much of the language of sin in contemporary 19th and 20th century theology has been what theologically we would call Pelagian. That is to say, it's been overly insistent on a sort of vaunted human agency. And in fact, if you go back in the theological tradition, when you read someone like Augustine, for instance, talking about sin, sin is often thought of in terms of a powerful habit that has gotten a grip over our lives and requires more than something just like, you know, positive thinking or the exertion of willpower to overcome. So I think when we actually think carefully about sin, about its power over our lives, then it turns out that the category of sin is not only capable of making sense of much of addiction, but is in many respects necessary for making sense of certain aspects of addiction.
Okay, so when we talk about even something like the paradox of addiction, when an addicted person, you know, claims that they are literally powerless over their addictive behavior, that admission is the starting point for regaining power over that same behavior. So explain that.
Yeah, so in the book I talk about what I call the paradox of addiction, which is that as you just put it, Bill, on the one hand, people claim a complete loss of agency or ability to act with respect to their addiction, but then as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous states, that very admission is itself the first step in the process of recovery. And it's important to understand that most of the time, in most cases, this process of recovery is in non-medicalized settings. So it doesn't involve pharmacological intervention or anything like that. So I suggest that the way to understand that is not to think that, in fact, people are utterly powerless over their addictions, but rather that they are utterly powerless to make a succession of choices to resist the addiction. So they have what you might call indirect control over their addiction, but they don't have direct control. So I think those who haven't been addicted, for instance, or don't understand the grip of extreme addiction, often think, why can't this person just for a period of time white knuckle it? Mm-hmm. And every time they have the desire to use, say no. And what the big book is saying when it says we've admitted we're powerless is that strategy doesn't work. But when it says that by admitting our powerlessness, we discover this is the first step in the process of recovery, what that's suggesting is that there's an indirect control we have over our addictive behaviors. And that indirect control is available because of our ability to create a different set of habits that provides an alternative course of action. So just to give one simple example, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a huge emphasis placed on what they call people, places, and things. So if you're an addict, probably instead of thinking about white-knuckling it every time you want a drink or a hit, what you have to think about is creating an alternative life with new people, new places, and new things. And if you direct your agency toward the formation of habits of sobriety, you may have a chance of beating your addiction. So it has to do with what you should be focusing your agency on. And the admission of powerlessness is simply a sort of wisdom that says, we found that if we just focused our agency on resisting addictive choice, we almost always fail.
Mm. Wow. Kent, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, more with Kent Dunnington, and his book is called Addiction and Virtue: Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. Thanks for being with us. We'll be right back. All right, we are having a very lively discussion with Kent Dunnington. He is the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Biola University, which I believe is in Southern Cal, isn't it?
That's right, in La Mirada in Orange County.
Oh, you know, I went from being jealous to being really jealous. That's a nice place to live.
Yeah, it's a good place to be.
Okay, Kent, your book, Addiction and Virtue: Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice, raises this question. What does any of this, alcoholism, addiction, or recovery, have to do with virtue?
Part of the point of the book is to get us thinking about addiction as what I call a complex habit. Virtues are habits. So if you think about a virtue like kindness, for instance, or a courage, let's say courage is a virtue. When we say that someone has the virtue of courage, what we mean is not simply that in certain circumstances they act courageously, but that they have a disposition to do so. In other words, they don't have to generate and exert profound willpower in order to act courageously. It's something that has become part of their character. And in the book, I argue that all habits, particularly complex habits, habits that affect the way we think, affect the way our body acts, these are strategies, what I call in the book strategies of desire. So we need lots and lots of habits to be able to get through our day smoothly. Otherwise, if we depended upon on willpower to make decisions moment after moment that contribute to our flourishing, we would be utterly exhausted. So what I suggest in the book is that the reason that addiction is so powerful, and in many ways this is the most important point I want to get across in the book. I want to get people out of the position of sort of moral critic mm-hmm. and into a position of sympathy with those who have major addictions. The reason that addiction is so powerful is because it does actually put us in a position to achieve many of the goods that people seek in life. Addiction has this powerful ability to order our lives, to make sense of our lives, to give us one pursuit that can help us make decisions about other aspects of our lives. The only problem is that it destroys us. Were it not for the incredible destructive power of addiction, objects of major addiction would in fact bring much order to our lives. And anything that can do that, anything that can make our lives better able to achieve what we think we need for flourishing, creates a habit. Virtues are, there's a long tradition of thinking about the virtues, which is thinking about those habits that if we work to create them will in fact bring about genuine flourishing. And so part of what I really want to suggest in the book is that the only antidote to a life of addiction is the creation of a life of deep virtue. And much as the first step of AA suggests, I think the way to respond to addiction is not, again, by white-knuckling it, but by thinking about communities and practices that enable us to create virtues that resist addictive ways of life.
Mm-hmm. I am taking notes as quickly as I can. The 12-step programs, and of course they do a great job of bringing people together in community, giving them a place to find sobriety, but it's also a place where there is a high rate of relapse. The success rate for people out of that program is not great, but it's also, as we are trying to see God through that program, they talk about God as we understand him. And that is going to be problematic for anybody who is looking for strength in a higher power, because only Jesus can deliver the higher power.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I talk about this some in the book. There's so much to learn from the 12-step tradition, and a big part of the book is trying to mine some of the wisdom from that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, I think the emphasis on what I call in the book apprenticeship relationships, so the idea of a sponsor is mm-hmm. a powerful idea that I think people in the church have a lot to learn from. The idea of confession as the centerpiece of a community of recovery is another idea that I think the church has a lot to learn from. Just mentioned in passing that one of the experiences that made me so interested in addiction recovery was attending a 12-step program with my mentor in mm-hmm. graduate school, who was a long-time recovering alcoholic. And I was astonished by the level of honesty and confession that was taking place in the room. And as someone who had grown up in the church, I remember thinking to myself, you know, this is the sort of thing that we're told is supposed to happen in the church, but rarely does. So there's so much to learn from the 12-step tradition. But like you say, Bill, there are theological problems in the development of that tradition. And one of them is the idea that we can be in control of sort of forming our own concept of whatever God will help us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from the Christian point of view, what that does is sort of rehearse yet again one of the problems that's at the root of addiction, which is an insistence on being in control of our own identity and our own destiny.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that people who are in the grips of major addiction lose control over their lives. That's true. but we ought not allow that to obscure the fact that one of the great attractions of addiction is that it provides us with a certain kind of control over our lives. And, I mean, AA and the 12-step tradition is sort of mixed about this, right? On the one hand, lots of it is about relinquishing control over our lives and undertaking an aggressive moral inventory, so on and so forth. But I think in an effort to have the biggest tent possible, AA makes a theological mistake of sort of putting, giving us too much control over our understanding of the higher power. And that's something that I think Christians can be rightfully worried about and critical of.
Mm-hmm. Kent, just as we wrap things up here, what do you think churches can do to be more welcoming to hearing people's issues when it comes to addiction? Because everybody kind of shows up Sunday on their best behavior, and they really don't want to end up on nine people's prayer lists under the form of gossip.
That's a great question, and the whole final chapter of my book is trying to grapple with that question. What kind of a church would be capable of resisting the powerful pull of addiction in all of our lives?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that I would like to say about that, particularly on this program, but I'll just say one thing. I think there's well-meaning Christians might have a perspective like this. Look, addiction is not a problem in my life, but I do want to be helpful to those who are addicted, and so I want my church to have programs that help such people. I appreciate that sentiment, and I know it comes from a good place. But I think that approach is not only probably not going to be helpful to people with major addictions, but it passes up an opportunity for a church to become a more authentic place of Jesus following.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we need to understand is that addicts in any society, addicts are what I call in my book unwitting prophets. They point us to all the ways in which our societies and our communities cut people off from lives of flourishing, from healthy lives.
Mm-hmm.
We need such people in our communities in the same way that coal miners needed canaries with them in the bottom of the coal mine, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I want to see happen more than anything is a shift in perspective where Christians in their church say, not only we want programs that help addicted persons in our congregation, but rather we want to be a kind of church where if a major addict walks in the front door to the Sunday morning service, they know soon upon arriving that this is a place where addiction is nothing to be ashamed of. And there are lots of ways of trying to achieve that. But I think to have that shift in perspective, not that addiction is a sort of serious problem that we should deal with in the shadows, but that to be a church where a major addict could walk in and begin to feel at home very quickly, that's a kind of shift in ethos in a church that I would want to encourage.
Mm. Kent, the world is a better place because you're in it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the book is called Addiction and Virtue Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. Dr. Kent Dunnington is the author and guest on the show. Thank you so much for being on the show, and have a great rest
good
of the day.
With you. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, we'll take a short break and be right back. It's a couple of minutes until the top of the hour. I hope you enjoyed today's show. We loved having you listen, and thank you for supporting Faith Radio. I was thinking of Psalm 73:26 after talking to Kent Dunnington that says, "My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." That's something to think about today as we go about your day. Have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow. I saw that there was a TSA agent in Boston at the Logan Airport giving credit for making a big catch over the weekend. They found a 20-pound lobster in someone's checked luggage. You know, that's how did that one get by? I would have done the humane thing, take it out to the woods and set it free. I don't know. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.